WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The beginning of the new year is a time to assess our lives and consider what changes we want to make. 20 years ago, my guest Bruce Chatwin examined his life and did what most of us would never dare to do. He gave up a very prestigious job and a cozy home life. He pulled up stakes to travel and write about it. His first stop was Africa, and his travels have since taken him to Iran, Afghanistan, China, the Soviet Union, and throughout Europe and South America. A New York Times book reviewer called Chatwin's 1978 book, In Patagonia, that perfect and most famous of recent travel books. After 20 years of traveling, Chatwin has come to see world history as what he calls a dialogue between the nomad and the settler. His attempt to understand the nature of human restlessness led him to Australia, where Aborigines go on nomadic walkabouts. Of particular interest to Chatwin were the Aboriginal songlines. These are the songlines passed on by the ancestors who are said to have left a trail of words and musical notes on the lines of their travels through the continent. The songlines are like musical maps that guide Aborigines through their ritual journeys across Australia. Chatwin's latest book is titled The Songlines. It's published by the Viking Press. I spoke with Bruce Chatwin from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. Before we talked about his own nomadic life, he explained the ancient Aboriginal myth of the songlines.
The original ancestor of a particular clan is created out of a waterhole, and the mud then, at the beginning of time, and the mud then falls from his limbs, and he sets out on a journey singing the world into existence. And he is thought to have left along the ground a track of song. So each one of his footprints corresponds to a musical note. And his present-day descendants are thought to own a stretch of that song. But they'll only own a bit of it. And that puts them in relation to other people up and down the song line, which may go on for about 1,000 miles. And they will be in contact, just as we're in contact between New York and Philadelphia over the telephone. They are in contact because they actually move and sing a section of the song to each other.
Do you find the idea of singing the world into existence a very compelling metaphor as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. It's what one would hope to do. Because all creation, any artistic endeavor, is supposed to be tapping into the original process of creation, or it should be, in my view, not destroying it as so much, or not saying that the whole thing is a dead end, which seems to be the preoccupation of not most at all, that's an exaggeration, but some 20th century art.
You've written in your book that, for me, the question of questions is the nature of human restlessness. And I suppose that's what got you, among other things, to study a nomadic people like the Aboriginals. But
absolutely.
What I'm wondering is that they don't really seem to be traveling because they're restless, but rather because they're desert dwellers, and if
yes.
they didn't travel, they'd be running out of food.
That is very true. The more arid conditions, the farther you have to travel. If you're in a plentiful environment, then where you don't have to travel, when everything sort of hangs from the bough, as it were, then you can, in theory, stay put. But the interesting thing is that the Australian Aboriginals did not stay put. They went out of their frontiers. They were on the move, even though they would go from very favored environments into the desert on visits and then back again. And that's the interesting question. And I don't quite know how to answer it.
Your restlessness interests me. You seem to be very restless yourself. You've been traveling for years now, and you've made a vocation of it. What makes you so restless?
I don't know. I suspect that it all... I mean, everything is supposed to happen to you before the age of 3. Anyway, I was brought up wandering around wartime England in that very, very highly charged atmosphere. I was born in 1940. My first recollections are of the Battle of Alamein, of hearing Winston Churchill coming through one of those brown plastic radios and then dancing around with my mother. I was hanging onto my grandmother's legs and her stockings fell down. I deeply remember. That's one of my first recollections. But we lived out of a suitcase. I All my early recollections are of, kit bags coming through windows, blackouts, and all those kind of exciting things. And we from one set of rented rooms to another, all through wartime England. And when we then settled down after the war in those rather grim post-war years in a house for the first time, it wasn't much of a house because we had no money, I associated settlement with some kind of terrible depression. And I think whenever I've, got holed up, as it were, then then my way of solving my particular crises is to move.
Well, you spent part of your early adulthood working at Sotheby's, the famous art auction house.
Yeah.
And I think you directed the Impressionism department for a while.
Roughly, yes.
But
there were others.
You gave up that life. You had a very good position.
Oh, yes.
What was there a turning point for you where you decided to give up a regular working job and to ditch it all so you could go travel?
Well, put it this way. My mother, when I left school, I wanted to travel in Africa. My mother didn't actually like the idea. My parents didn't quite like the idea of their 18-year-old son sort of dashing around Africa. But they sort of said, well, okay, fine. You could go and work in Sotheby's as a porter for a little while, and then if you don't like it, then you can go. But just sort of give it a try. So I went and I worked as a porter, and then I became a kind of instant expert. Those were the days in the art business when nobody seemed to know very much. Within a matter of no time, I was pronouncing with sort of insufferable arrogance on the authenticity of paintings, whether they were genuine or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, I had this career in the art business. But then I got a kind of psychosomatic eye complaint. My right eye went rather funny. And the eye surgeon to whom I went in London said, Bruce, I think you've been looking too closely at pictures. There's nothing wrong with you organically. Why don't you swap them for some long horizons? Where would you like to go? So I said Africa, which was the place which I'd somehow been prevented from going to before. So I went to Africa, and then I saw nomad peoples for the first time, and I felt it was quite wonderful the way in which my travelling companions had this immense pride in having nothing, whereas all our pride, or my particular pride up till then, had been towards accumulation of things and everything else.
Had you been collecting a lot of art?
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful group of things, even bought on a shoestring, but I had things which would today be worth I don't know what.
Well, you say that in the past tense. Did you decide to sell off your collection?
Yeah, they all got flogged off to in order to pay for journeys one way or another. And I don't regret them. One or two things I do regret, rather. Yes.
So you were willing to throw off your collection and your possessions so you'd be freer to travel?
Absolutely. Yes, the two work against each other.
I want to quote something that you say in your book. You say psychiatrists, politicians, tyrants are forever warning us that the wandering life is an aberrant form of behavior, a sickness which, in the interest of civilization, must be suppressed. Was that attitude the one that was around you when you decided to travel? Were you discouraged
Not
from
really.
Traveling?
They thought it was a bit of madness, but they always knew. I suppose my friends and family knew that I was. I like to be kind of professionally unavailable. Of course, that is kind of unacceptable if you're in business. You have to be somewhere on the end of the telephone. You have to make contact. And it seems to me to be one of the great luxuries of the 20th century is if you can make yourself unavailable. I think that's the greatest luxury I can think of.
What do you mean, like getting away from the telephone?
Yes, absolutely. Out of touch. That's the situation I like to be in.
Why do you want to be out of touch?
I just don't want. I don't want to be bothered. Say right now, writing a book or whatever, you have to have your head free from all those sort of other things that get to you. Otherwise, you get sort of lured back into the web.
Most of us, when we travel, take suitcases of clothes and books, and I know some people who even take television sets and video cassette recorders so they
God
can catch up on movies when
God
they're traveling.
God help them! Yes, God help them.
Do you travel light?
Oh, absolutely. I have a little sort of rucksack. This is, I suppose, a bit of a show-off remark, but the great and wonderful French actor Jean-Louis Barrault was somebody I met. I met him on a plane, and he had at his feet the most beautiful leather rucksack, very, very small. I mean, tiny, really tiny. And I asked him about it, and he said, I've got an apartment in Paris. I live there with my wife and everything else. But actually, this object, which I bought to go on a walking tour when I was 16 in the Tyrol in the 30s, is my home. And I have to say that I copied that, and I took a look at it, and I even had a found a piece of sort of string, and we sort of measured how much it was and where the pocket fitted on this thing, actually on the plane. He then went off and he said, no, sure, of course you do that. And I had one made, and it's a kind of pillow, comforter. There's a slot in the side for a bottle. When I went to Patagonia, I put a half bottle of rather good champagne in the pocket for the worst possible moment. And otherwise, I really take nothing, hardly anything in it, just a change of warm clothes, and I'm off. And one watches, if you go into those wild places, you watch, very often you find expeditions of university expedition to this and that, with a lot of very bad-tempered people all looking around a Land Rover which has got stuck in the dust or the mud, and I must say I'm thankful for my little rucksack that enables me to go on to the next thing.
I love this idea of having a little bottle of champagne for the worst possible moment. what was the occasion for actually drinking it?
In Tierra del Fuego, which is one of the most sort of grisly, but it isn't so cold, but it's pretty wet. There's a constant storm going, a constant rainstorm. And I did, I was crossing one of those kind of corrugated paths of logs across a swamp, and one of the logs got dislodged, and I went in. I never thought that I'd actually come out again, this glutinous black mud, and covered from head to foot, quite cold, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. That is the moment when I sat down and drank my half bottle.
Did it taste good?
Delicious. Krug is an excellent mark.
Has the world become a more or less hospitable place to travel in since you started traveling all the time?
Hospitable or inhospitable?
Yeah, I'm asking you, hospitable or inhospitable?
Well, I mean,
there wasn't so much terrorism when you started traveling, and
No. There
were probably many more full-time travelers. I'm thinking of all the hippies who were traveling in the 60s.
Yes.
There's not that much traveling, I think.
I suppose not. The answer is, of course, that just as one, you know, when I was traveling in Afghanistan in the 60s, say northeastern Afghanistan, late 60s, there we'd got as far as you could go in that direction. And the idea that the China of Mao Zedong would ever be open, it was a kind of mirage, it was a sort of dream that nobody could imagine that frontier would be open. And nowadays, absolutely everyone one knows is in Tibet. I mean, you know, the South Bronx would be more exotic than Tibet, you know, most people, because every one of one's friends is sort of going. Anyway.
That's interesting. There's little fads in travel, huh?
Of course. But what I'm saying is that when just as one place becomes inhospitable and impossible to travel in, I mean, I don't see the chances of my being able to travel with the tribes in Iran at the moment. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I could go to see their equivalents in somewhere in Western China perfectly easily now. So just as one place folds in and becomes sort of, as it were, a terrorist zone or whatever it happens to be, then somewhere else in the world comes open. I talked to the mountaineer Chris Bonington, who was saying that, you know, certain mountains now are politically impossible to climb, but then other ones are now open. And I think that's rather the way the world moves. I reckon that we're all going to be able to travel in the Soviet Union in within 5 or 10 years. I think we're going to know what it's like to be in the Siberian forest, in the taiga of northern Siberia, and be perfectly free to move. Whereas I think that certain places which we're accustomed to going will be absolutely impossible.
My guest is Bruce Chatwin. He's a novelist and also a travel writer. His books include In Patagonia and a new book called The Song Lines, which is about the time that he spent observing Aboriginals and thinking about travel in Australia. And we're going to take a short break, then we'll be back and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Bruce Chatwin is my guest. I'm going to read something from a New York Times book review of your book. This was from the cover of the Sunday Book Review section in early August, and the reviewer was Andrew Harvey, who is also English. And he writes, "Nearly every writer of my generation in England has wanted at some point to be Bruce Chatwin. No writer has meant as much to my generation. From Mr. Chatwin, we learned to dare to be obsessive, irregular, learned, exotic, learned to burn our school ties and Wellingtons, learned to mock and avoid a literary establishment that loves to reward poems to goldfish and novels about the tepid lusts of women librarians."
Heavens. Right.
Well, Bruce Chatwin, did you feel like you were the envy of your generation when you pulled up stakes and started traveling yourself, and that you were setting an example for others?
Never. Wouldn't have entered my head. No,
really?
That's not the kind of thing that entered my head, no. It was rather funny, not so long ago, they my school sent out a frantic sort of message, somebody saw it, saying that I went to a school called Marlborough, and it's one of those English public schools that everyone's read about in those rather sinister novels about boys being beaten, that kind of thing. If you went there, you're called an old Marlburian. And I was on the list of missing Marlburians. I thought it was rather emblematic.
You've been married for 22 years?
Yes.
Do you ever travel with your wife?
Oh, of course. Yes. Rather. And she's a much more intrepid traveler than I am, I might say. Now, we're having a role reversal situation now. I mean, for example, I am now going back I'm going to sit in France for the next few months and try and write nothing to do with travel at all, but about a man who is absolutely stuck in a bed sitting room in Prague, because that's, you know, that's, after all, another side of human life. And she, meanwhile, is going off hiking in the Himalayas and that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, writing absolutely, you know, does fetter you down to one position. I find that I can't really get up steam to write a book unless I'm sedentary for some period of time anyway.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you were forced to be sedentary for a while pretty recently when you had a rare sickness that you contracted, I think, from a plant fungus on your travels.
Well, something like that. Nobody quite knows what it was. It was a very rare and exotic thing, which They didn't know what the hell was the matter with me, and they sort of came in, until suddenly one day somebody came in and they said, they asked me all the places I had been. They said, this is something which is not recognizable anywhere. We tried everything. You must give a list of all your travels over the past 5 years. And so I said, well, you know, could I have got sleeping sickness in Brazil? Could I, you know, we went through great geographical tramp, but I was a bit gaga at the time. And I neglected to tell them that I had recently been in Western China, in the province of Yunnan. And one day the doctor said, I think we've got what it is. Have you been doing one of two things, consorting with killer whales on the coast of Arabia or with peasants in Yunnan? I said, well, the weekly peasants. And that is what it was. And so I had, in fact, probably gone to a place in Western China on the Tibetan border, which had just opened up to Westerners. And I got this particular thing. Then once they knew what that was, which was a thing that affected the bone marrow, they could prescribe the right drug, or rather the drug worked, and I came too, so that was all right.
Now, I'm thinking about what a terrible profession travel would be for a hypochondriac. Think of all the...
Yes, you don't have time to think about that.
Yeah. do you worry about that when you travel?
Not in the least, no. No, absolutely not.
I guess you couldn't travel if you did.
No, sure.
You'd be paranoid all the time.
Yes, but, I mean, people are paranoid all the time, and one just can't be bothered with it. You know, and so what? I mean, you know, you get stricken by something and that's it.
Pop
that's
open
it.
The champagne afterwards, huh?
Yes, I think one needs another bottle. Yes.
Does illness bring out your homing instincts?
Not in the least, no. Not at all.
I'm surprised because I know on those rare times when I get to travel, if I get sick, I really want to go home. That doesn't happen to you?
No, this is a bit of a, you know, this is all rather a long shot. No, my immediate impulse was to get the hell out. I always have this idea that, this is rather strong stuff in a way. I always have the idea that really if one has to, I don't like those sort of end of the road scenes. I have this idea that one should really sort of step out into the wilderness and disappear. I have this great fantasy of disappearing one day, you know, just fading out somewhere in some remote place.
Disappearing to others?
What?
Disappearing to others. I mean, you mean still having a life but not being
seen
by others.
Oh, that too. Yes, I'd love that. I'd love to do that one day. That'd be great, wouldn't it? I rather hope to end my days perhaps as a sort of... Brazil is the country that I think is very nice. I have a vision. I don't think it'll come off, but I have a vision of myself being a sort of papery old English gentleman, reading at last the literature of his own country, which I don't know at all. I mean, I don't think I've hardly ever read a novel by Dickens, say. But I really want to... I'm saving them up. I want to have the Brontes, George Eliot, Jane Austen, and Dickens particularly. I think I want to live above a cafe in Brazil and have sort of somebody take up the meals to this sort of papery old gentleman. I want to come down in sloppy white suit and a big Panama, papery looking, and sit and watch the Paseo in the evening and go up and read about English country life upstairs.
Do you think this is the kind of
mosquito,
old age befitting someone who's traveled all their life?
Absolutely.
You know, I called you, Bruce Chatwin, a travel writer earlier, and I wasn't sure if you'd bristle at that.
I'll say expression. I'm bristling now, yes. I don't see the meaning of it. I don't quite get the meaning of it. After all, the word travel, let's face it, what does travel really mean? It means, it's the same word as the French travail. It means work. And any writing is work, and so it's a form of traveling anyway. I was brought up to the notion that, I think it's something to do with, if you live on little islands like we have to, I forget who said that England was that tight little island. You know, I think it was some sort of American wit during the war. And if you live there, you have two options. Either you enter into that rather closed, hermetical system, or else you just treat the world as your back door. And I rather hope to do that. I just looked at the map and thought looked at the atlases when I was a child and thought this is where I'm at home. And I don't necessarily see the great virtue of this word travel.
Well, obviously for you, going to different countries, different continents all the time gives you good material to write about.
Sure, absolutely. And if you're sort of floating free, people then talk to you much more. If you're unidentifiable, basically, if you're just that odd Englishman who's sort of sitting there, then people will come and tell you your stories. If you go and investigate, and you're a kind of marked man, you don't float free, and you maybe get less, I think. But to me, the fascination of travel, and you don't have to travel very far, is just to put yourself into a position whereby you're receptive to receiving stories, and providing you're receptive, they come to you. You don't have to invent. You get things which are more or less magical. I don't hold with the whole notion of the sort of fantasy in literature. I don't really like it. I don't like what's called magic realism. I think that the real is infinitely more magical than the magical.
Have you ever been in a place hoping that people will come to you with their stories, when you've noticed that, say, Paul Theroux is there too, waiting for the same thing,
or another writer? No, Paul and I are great friends. We're particularly telephone friends. We very rarely hitch up, but when we do, we have a kind of all-in telephone session, swapping information. And I've never met him on travels, no. Though we've covered some of the same ground.
The German director, Werner Herzog, who
yes.
did the movies Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, and a recent version of Nosferatu, is filming a movie based on one of your novels.
Right.
And the novel is called The Viceroy of Ouida?
Ouida.
Thank
Ouida.
You.
Ouida, yes.
Which is about a Brazilian slave trader in Africa.
Right. And Klaus Kinski is in the role.
Great.
And pretty wild he is, too. And we have 750, I think, Amazons, who are all girls from Accra. Very nice girls they were, but they got a bit riotous at times. They had lovely names. They were called Beatrice, Patience, Mavis, Maud, Rhoda. And I was sitting with them as they were stripping down, changing into their Amazon costumes, which is sort of cash sex, bit of whiting smeared on, helmet, machete. They've been trained for 8 weeks in machete drill. And spears. And we'd hear things like, take off your brassiere, Jemima, or Women in Europe do not do that, Rhoda. And they were great. I liked them very much. And they nearly did stage a riot at one point, but that's beside the point.
That was overpay.
Well, they'd gone on strike twice in order for extra pay, and then they tried to dock some of it back again, and that imposed some problems, particularly when you have a. I mean, they were, after all, trained to be an army, and it's rather difficult to resist that kind of pressure.
Well, movie makers are getting into some very difficult situations now, going to third world countries and paying people as extras and then finding out that the actors want more. And in some ways, I think that the filmmakers are being seen as the new colonialists.
I think on the whole, a good time, maybe new colonialists, but I think in the end, a good time was had by all. I mean, it was... Werner Herzog is the most remarkable character. He doesn't... on the one hand, doesn't stand for nonsense, but he's very, very fair about the dealing things. And in fact, although he pushes himself into what might be only be described as extreme situations in order to get those rather extreme movies, he himself becomes a kind of pillar of sanity in the cast of Nervous Breakdowns. Anyway...
Well, as you get older, are you still as interested in travel as you've always been? Are you thinking of settling down?
Well, I thought I might like... Yes, I thought a few years ago that I was sort of kind of coming to the end and really it was time to sort of cross one's legs and take up Zen practices or something like that. I mean, just sort of sitting there. But I have to say that the itch has got me again and I'm off.
Where are you going?
Oh, Madagascar.
And what's the lure of Madagascar?
It's a great and fascinating situation of people who have come across the Indian Ocean. They're basically Indonesians mixed with African peoples, and there's a most amazing social situation. And anyway, I'm hoping to go there in the fall.
Well, I wish you the best on your travels. Bruce Chatwin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hi.
Bruce Chatwin's books include In Patagonia and On the Black Hill. His latest book, Songlines, about Aborigines in Australia, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.